hearing on Senate Bill 483, FNA, relative to the interpretation of Internal Revenue Code Section 1031 as it relates to taxation under the business profits tax. I do note I do not yet have a card from the DRA and will be needing one. And I call on Senator Del Senator to open the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and distinguished members of the committee. For the record, my name is Luis Alessandro. I'm a state senator from District 20. That's Manchester Wards 3, 4, 10, 11 in the town of Goffstown. Come before you as the prime sponsor of Senate Bill 483. This legislation is designed to correct what's clearly an injustice to a group of New Hampshire residents as well as out-of-state investors who've been essentially entrapped by the Department of Revenue Administration. As a result of this, New Hampshire's reputation in the investing world has received a black eye. We must repair that damage today. Imagine playing a game under which everyone on the playing field agrees are a set of rules. The game ends. You win, and everyone goes home. Years later, the umpire declares a new set of rules now apply to that game, now long completed. Instead of winning, you're declared the loser. This is unfair, yet this is what has happened to these people. There was no reasonable way that a person conducting one of these like-kind exchanges could have known that at some future date, the DRA would repudiate a statute and apply a tax. These taxpayers tried to do the right thing. They sought and received advice from lawyers and accountants. They followed the law. I certainly do not need to remind anyone in this room that that's the New Hampshire legislators' responsibility to make tax law for New Hampshire, not the Department of Revenue Administration. Can our Department of Revenue point to anything that we as the duly elected officials of this state ever said or did that would justify this type of reinterpretation of the statutes? Why didn't they come to us if they had a question about our intent? Where was the hearing by DRA to discuss this change? Where was the outreach to explain this new interpretation? Why should New Hampshire be one of only two states that tax these sorts of 1031 transactions? Last June, the DRA told this body that they were working to address this issue through rulemaking, but they were already applying the tax when they told us that. They did this without a public hearing or ever reaching out to CPAs or the legal community to explain their new interpretation. How could anyone have known that DRA would begin to tax 1031 transactions in this manner? There are too many questions as to how and why this occurred, but the bill before you is the answer to all these questions. Let's talk about fairness. I know at least one Manchester resident who transferred his land in exchange for an income-generating commercial project. That project went bankrupt, and he's now broke. I know there are others who will provide the committee with more detailed explanations of 1031 transactions, and I defer to them. I ask you to do the right thing for the people and send a message that New Hampshire is a great place to do business and pass this legislation. Thank you very much, Madam Chairman, and happy to address any queries that may come my way that I can address.
Thank you. Representative Asher?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator, for taking my question. Now, in your testimony, you said that there was no way that the public would know the DRA would repudiate a statute and impose a tax. I believe that was what you said. What statute specifically are you referring to? Are you referring to the Section 1031 of the IRS code?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And how the DRA had been interpreting that over the years.
Can I follow up, Madam Chair? And the reason why I asked my question is because I've been trying to figure out what state law applied to this situation, if any, and I haven't been able to really put my finger on it. And so do you have any insight into that?
I don't.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Weiler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Representative Weiler.
From your testimony, I discerned that this was just an interpretation by the DRA. There was no legislation that suddenly changed the way we did this, but their own interpretation.
Yes, that's how I understand it, Representative Weiler. That we had gone through a process whereby we treated these transactions in one manner for a number of years, then all of a sudden we had a differential methodology by
without any legislation.
That's correct.
Thank you very much.
Representative Major.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And thank you, Senator, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Did I hear you say that there's only two states that do this?
That's correct.
And New Hampshire's never done this?
That's correct.
And it's not in our laws to do this?
As I understand it, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sabrudo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And following up, thank you, Senator, too. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Following up on his question, why hasn't there been change in rules?
That's the $64 question. What, and maybe DRA can address that. I'm here to tell you, candidly and quite explicitly, that a change took place in the methodology of how we treated these 1031 items in the past, and how we're now looking at them as we move forward. There's a totally different methodology in place. The DRA is going to have to address that situation as they are the people who bring it forward.
Thank you. Representative Major.
Senator, I believe you've been associated with the Ways and Means Committee in the Senate for a number of years, and I have been associated with the Ways and Means Committee in the House for a number of years. And I can't recall any legislation authorizing this at all.
I think you're absolutely right, Representative Major. And thanks for the clarification. I was associated with Ways and Means in the Senate, still am. I chaired Ways and Means in the Senate for three terms, now serve as vice chair. And I know that you've chaired this committee and been on this committee for a number of years. And for full disclosure, Representative Major is my classmate at the University of New Hampshire. He's one of the distinguished graduates of 1961. I'm just an ordinary graduate.
Oh, no.
Appreciate that association. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator, I thought I saw you possibly reading testimony. If you'd like to submit that for the written record, I would appreciate it.
I would be most happy to do that, Representative.
Thank you.
So these words can be in the permanent record. That's what we need, the permanent record.
Thank you. And could you explain to us what you amended in the bill in the Senate?
Yes, the date. It became effective immediately. That was the amendment.
So the original bill was effective when? Because we don't know whether the fiscal note changes. Of course, the fiscal note doesn't say much. Well, it does say something.
Well, the fiscal notes are getting more voluminous as we move forward.
Yeah, the methodology says it. I'm still not used to having to go to the methodology to see the bottom line. Right.
The original act called for January 1st, 2010. The amendment was effective upon passage.
Okay.
2011, excuse me. Be the first of a number of trips I'm going to make before you today.
Yes.
We're going to create a synergistic relationship you and me as we move forward along right. this path. So I'm
thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
I call Representative Andy I believe it's Peterson. It's Peterborough, I think. So I think that might be a Peterson. In support of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Andy Peterson representing Hillsborough District Number 3. Hopefully I can speak more legibly than I write. But I'm here to second the statements of Senator D'Alessandro and to ask the committee to support this bill and reverse the situation, which is, I think as you will hear from others, in testimony today, patently unfair and a significant drag on the attempts of our recovery, of our economy to recover. As a real estate professional and in commercial real estate sales since 1979, I can tell you that although it may seem mysterious to the uninitiated with what happens in a 1031 exchange, this is really the way that business is done relating to commercial and investment property in a significant number of cases. And for our state to stand nearly alone among all the states in treating this 1031 exchange differently in terms of its tax treatment than the federal government is something which is indeed a significant problem for New Hampshire going forward if we leave it in place. It's obviously a significant problem for those who are unaware of it and who had transactions that they now are receiving very significant tax bills on that were unanticipated. But basically what is happening in an exchange of this kind is that at the most basic level, a person has an investment, or a group has an investment, that they do not wish to be in anymore. They wish to move the money from that investment into one they do wish to be in. This is the very stuff of life of an economy. If you halt that flow from one to the other, a few things happen. And one of them is that less people are employed, there is less money available to create jobs and promote economic growth, and you may hear the jingle of keys on the desk of the local bank, because people will find that they actually are unable to transfer out of assets that they no longer want and need. So this bill, although it may seem technical, I think you will find is anything but. This is a very important economic development measure, and I hope that the committee will support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative, for taking my question. My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the problem is not with the like-kind exchange. In other words, if you and I decide to swap property that are similar in nature, and I take possession of yours and you take possession of mine, that transaction is not taxed under the business profits tax. My understanding is the problem is created, let me go back to that example I just gave you, I transfer a piece of property that I own to you, and you transfer a piece of property to me, but not to me directly, but to Bill Johnson LLC, for instance. Is that the problem?
You'll hear expert testimony from others on the exact nature of the problem, and I do believe it has to do with that distinction between a wholly owned LLC and holding something individually in your individual name. This distinction, as I understand it, is not seen as substantive by the federal government, but our tax authorities have decided to make it so, and it's substantive to a level which is chilling in terms of its entire tax effect on many transactions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Oscar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Peterson, for taking my question. When this bill apparently came out of the darkness of night into the light of day, and all of a sudden you guys are, I'm not in that business, but you're all of a sudden seeing this bill being applied or this law being applied.
On Representative Osgood, there is, we've established there is no new law or bill or anything like that that is being applied. The DRA has been using existing law to do this.
When this method came out of the darkness of night into the light, and you saw it being applied, are you experiencing a look back on this as well, where they're looking back years?
I do not personally have a client who is caught in this circumstance. Had sales been more brisk over the course of the last year, I might have, and then I might be happier about it. As it is, I can tell you that it is something that I am understanding that people are experiencing after the fact.
Thank you very much. I would like to ask at this point if there's anyone who has to leave very soon, because I would like to take the DRA next so that everybody can understand the other side of the argument.
If
that's okay. So I would call Kathleen Scher of the Department of Revenue Administration, who is neither supporting nor opposing, but has written testimony. And Mindy Scher. Who didn't sign up. I will sign it.
Not quite, huh? So who do we have?
I have Melinda Scher is together with Kathleen Scher, the legal minds of the department. Scher is S-H-E-R. Scher is C-Y-R.
Let's see her.
What I've passed around is, first of all, an analysis done by the American Bar Association, the tax section of the American Bar Association, regarding Section 1031 like-kind exchanges. It's a state survey, and it analyzes
We seem to be missing a couple.
How many? I only have
only one.
We've only got one missing.
Okay. Half one left.
Though we had several committee members missing, so there weren't 20.
Somebody's holding on to them.
Oh, this is something else. This is an overview of the DRA position.
Okay.
Does everyone have the overview?
There's an overview, and then there's a survey from the American Bar Association tax section. Everyone like that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you for inviting me to speak. My name is Kathleen Scher, and I am the acting director of the audit division of the Department of Revenue Administration. I neither support nor oppose this legislation. This is purely a policy decision as to what the legislature wants to do. But I thought it would be appropriate to share with you why we're doing what we're doing and what exactly it is that's going on. You've heard testimony that we are one of only two states who don't recognize 1031 like-kind exchanges. Well, in a limited circumstance, we are one of two states that don't recognize a particular type of transaction. If you look at this survey from the American Bar Association, this is from 2005. It's a survey of many jurisdictions across the country and how they treat various elements of 1031. And you'll see from this that it isn't uniformly recognized consistently throughout the country. States have various tweaks and twists that they use in interpreting whether or not they will recognize a 1031 like-kind exchange. So you can read through that at your leisure. I would point out that for most circumstances, New Hampshire recognizes anything that is a 1031 like-kind exchange that the federal government would recognize, except when it is being conducted through a disregarded entity. Disregarded entities are a federal concept. They have no place in New Hampshire as profits tax law. And I would just mention, Representative Johnson, what your scenario is exactly what we're talking about here. It's a situation where a commercial entity has a piece of property that they want to divest themselves of, but they don't necessarily want to cash it out. They replace it with another commercial property of like kind. And there are very strict rules under 1031 for how this is accomplished. And one of those rules is that it has to be accomplished by the same person. It can't be, all right, I'm going to take this property that I have in the parent company, and then my partially owned subsidiary over here is going to take the new property. That doesn't work. The federal government has made an exception in the situation of single-member SMLLCs, okay, single-member LLCs, to afford them the character of a disregarded entity. In other words, federal government does not view the SMLLC as separate and apart from its parent organization. Therefore, the exchange is taking place through the same person. We have a very different structure for taxation here in New Hampshire. We tax on a separate entity basis. Every entity, every New Hampshire entity, files its own tax return, regardless of the ownership.
Can you say that last two sentences again?
I'll try. New Hampshire taxes on a separate entity basis. Every New Hampshire business entity files its own tax return. The only exception to that is the situation of multinational or multi-state companies that will file on a combined basis, but they still have to analyze their income in terms of separate entity analysis. So that being the structure of New Hampshire, the New Hampshire statutes, we looked at these transactions, and these are new. These transactions are quite new. The federal government did not give this status of disregarded entity for SMLLCs until, I believe, it was 1998. And there's been lots of analysis since that time about what types of transactions are taxable or not taxable. So it's not a black and white area, even for federal purposes. We started seeing these transactions in 2006. I think that was the first one we recognized as being an issue. And we certainly did not think that we were changing a law or imposing a new analysis. We simply applied the separate entity analysis that we always apply to business transactions. And so you'll see on that fiscal note that in the current fiscal period, I believe there's about $5 million that we would stand to lose under this bill. Now, that's $5 million that is currently either assessed or currently in audit. So that's real money. And that's only 20 taxpayers. We've only identified 20 of these transactions so far. We understand from the industry that there are many, many more, but we haven't found a systematic way of identifying them yet. So I can't give you a firmer picture of what we might be losing in general, either by using this this bill or not. But that $5 million is an actual dollar amount that is currently in the audit division or assessed or proposed.
Thank you. Have you said all you feel you need to say about
it? I think so. It really is quite simple. It's that distinction between how the feds tax and how the state taxes. The federal government, when you have one of these transactions, they're not foregoing any revenue. They're simply deferring that revenue. They will get their money when this, when the property is ultimately sold by that SMLLC. The state, we're a separate entity, and I wouldn't be, you know, we're arguing separate entity. Taxpayers will certainly come back on us and say, you can't collect this tax because it is not the same entity. We also have a problem with how gains and losses are going to be identified in each of the entities. We tax separately. So if the property is now in the hands of another entity, it's not reflecting the economic reality for New Hampshire tax purposes. Also, this isn't necessarily a loss so much for the, it shouldn't be a loss for the taxpayer. The taxpayer could very easily engage in the 1031 like kind exchange as normal and transfer the property to the SMLLC after the fact, in which case New Hampshire never sees a dime of it, but that's certainly, you know, an option. I think it's just that perhaps people got caught unaware, but on the same token, they didn't ask, and we have a process and a procedure for that. Like I said, these are new transactions, and not a single taxpayer asked for a ruling on this issue. How we would look at these types of transactions, given our separate entity analysis, which is no secret. It's well identified in the statute and the rules. And I have some cites to that there in the overview.
Thank you. Now, questions, Representative Major, Saperetto, White.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you for your testimony. I have a question, but first of all, I want to say is that over the 12 years I spent with the Ways and Means Committee, whenever the DRA had a question about interpretation or if the situation changes, they would usually come before the committee and recommend that, say, a technical correction or things like that, or we need to get this interpreted because this is what the situation is changing into. Why didn't the DRA come to us with this issue saying, hey, this is something new that's come along, it's not clearly defined, and it needs to be defined? And why didn't the DRA do what they've been doing in the past?
My short answer to that is that we didn't see it as being that ambiguous a situation. We simply applied the statutes and the rules the way they are written and in conformance with maintaining the spirit of the law. I guess my short answer is no, there was no question as far as we were concerned as to whether these were taxable events.
Can I follow up?
Follow up.
But you did say in 2006 this is the first time we've seen this, and this is something mm-hmm. new.
The transaction was something new, but the analysis under the statute was pretty straightforward. The transaction is a transaction we've never seen before.
So the DRA did not have a concern. It's black and it was black and white at that point in time.
We thought so.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Saperetto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you again for your testimony. I'm looking at lines 7 and 8 on the bill, which talks about specifically the same entity. It says a place in irrevocable trust, which is generally done for liability issues, and a single member limited liability company or other entity disregarded as entity under the provisions of the United States Revenue Code. Mm-hmm. So it appears to me that the intent of the bill then is to find an exact the same owner, make sure we're taxing the same people.
That appears to be the intent of the bill. Okay. However, I would also point you to the definition of a business organization, and an SMLLC is a separate business organization. So
I understand. Forget my question now. is that the intent of this bill is to make sure we're not attacking the same person again with a like-type exchange, which I believe is what the intent that we've always tried to do. Let me place the question this way. We had an issue with, it says a trust here. We place clients in trust for liability issues for exemption for the home, qualified homestead exemption and so forth. Effectively the same owner. Now, isn't this bill, we're doing the same thing here, aren't we, by identifying the owner of the trust? If I have a revocable trust of which I am a trustee, then the entity is still me, whether it's, and Amber Banks would not allow that because they said, oh, it's a different name, but it's the same owner.
A grantor trust the same thing. Is not a business organization for business profits tax.
I was using it as an example, but my point is, my question is that the intent here clearly is to make sure we are going to allow the exact same physical person to have that same like-kind exchange as any other entity organization. That appears to me as clear intent. My question to you is, why was that not recognized when you decided to interpret it differently in 2006 when you first saw it, or either question rules? Same question I put to
someone. I would take issue with the term interpret it differently. We didn't interpret anything differently. We interpret it consistently. An SMLLC has always been a separate business entity apart from its owner for purposes of New Hampshire taxation. That's been that way since the inception.
That's the point. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wiley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If this tax is being imposed as under the business profits tax statute, then someone pays like for like. Whether it's I pay $1 million for the property or I swap $1 million property for $1 million property. Where is the profit that is being taxed?
There is a gain. There is a realized gain, even if it is not recognized at this point. The property that you might have paid $200,000 for 5 years ago is now being exchanged for $1 million property. That's where the gain comes in. There's an $800,000 gain in that situation. Whether it is recognized in the current year or recognized in a year down the road when the property is ultimately sold, that's what 1031 is all about.
So my follow-up question is, how far back are you going with this? If I made this exchange 2 years ago, are you still looking at this in an audit?
Well, yes, an audit period is a three-year period. That's standard. We have a statute of limitations that doesn't allow us to look back more than 3 years, but a three-year period is a standard audit period.
So your 20 taxpayers that are involved in the fiscal note, how many of them are
five exchanges for insurance
previous years?
They all are because this is all accomplished through audit. Audit is always a look back.
Thank you.
Representative Hatch.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. You addressed explaining the gain. I thought that was important to get out. And I think that clarifies that. And again, it's just if I'm transferring it out from an LLC, from a person to an LLC, then that's a gain for that separate entity. And that's what's taxable, correct?
It's the gain
even though the owner's the same, but it's a separate.
The gain is in the person doing the transfer, not the person receiving the property. The one receiving the property now takes a basis in that property of $1 million.
Okay, right. Okay, that's good. Thanks.
Representative Sacramento.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following on that line of questioning, then if I exchange my $500,000 property for a $20,000 property, do I receive credit back?
It's got to be like kind, and that's one of the rules under 1031. The assumption would be there's boot involved in that, and you would have gotten cash, and that would be a nice gain on.
Right. But if I didn't receive boot,
But if you didn't receive boot and you traded a $500,000 property,
I purposely reduced my estate for other purposes.
It probably wouldn't qualify as a like-kind exchange.
Right. But it would if I went up in value.
Or state-wise.
Incompetent. What if I went up in value, though?
Incompetency there somewhere.
There's other reasons you might have to do that.
That's right. Getting divorced.
One of them is a number.
Could I ask you if we recognized a single member LLC as a disregarded entity, not a business entity, for this purpose, would we have to do it for all purposes?
Would you have to? Probably not, but it would certainly become a very difficult position for the department to maintain on audit or going forward. Why would it be disregarded for this purpose and not for other purposes? There's a consistency issue in how you treat a taxpayer, and that would create a real murky situation.
By murky, you mean
that? Meaning, when do we treat this as a separate entity and tax it as a separate entity, and when do we treat it as a disregarded entity? And if you don't do one or the other, say you do have a transaction here in, and you said that the SMLLC for this purpose is a disregarded entity. Well, how is that LLC to be treated going forward in its business life?
Thank you. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for taking my question. I go back to the example that I used with Representative Peterson that you already mentioned before, where the change of ownership in the separate entity now is not Bill Johnson as a single individual, but now Bill Johnson as a single member LLC. My question is, if that LLC becomes a multi-member LLC, does that change it at all in terms of New Hampshire law and also federal law?
If it later becomes?
If instead of?
Or
I exchange. Representative Walsh and I form an LLC,
yes.
A partnership. I have a piece of property that I own in my name that I transfer. I do a like-kind exchange with Representative Peterson, and I take back his property, but I have it in the name of the partnership or
the feds would not allow that as a like-kind exchange because it is not under even their definitions the same taxpayer.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, I think that the parties don't have to be the same in the transaction. You don't have to be swapping property back and forth with the same parties. It's the fact that you're changing one form of property for another. That's the like-kind exchange. It's not an exchange between parties. It's between properties.
But the person receiving the property has to be the same person
as
the one giving them.
Yes, because they're the ones that are doing the exchange of properties rather than a...
Yes.
I have one more question.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, in terms of the date, Kathleen, in your testimony about 1998, you were saying 1031s for SMLLC started being recognized by the federal government in 1998. Is that when they started recognizing SMLLCs, or is that when they started doing 1031s? I just don't know.
No. 1031s have a long, long history, and we've always recognized the 1031 like-kind exchange. The SMLLC and this concept of a disregarded entity for federal tax purposes is what was new. If years ago, There were IRS rules that were used to characterize whether an entity was a corporate entity or whether it was a partnership type of entity. And those rules were getting very murky because of the LLC entities, which had just come to the fore. So they threw away all those rules and came up with new rules that allow an entity to choose whether it will be taxed as a corporation or as a partnership. And along with that, in that analysis, this idea of an SMLLC was given the treatment of as a disregarded entity because it's wholly owned by its individual owner or its partnership owner or its corporate owner or what have you. And that's another thing to keep in mind is this isn't just transactions with an individual and his SMLLC. This is corporations, large corporations with huge amounts of commercial property and their SMLLCs.
I had another one I'm still trying to clarify the thought I had on this, which is on, you say that it would be very unclear if we allowed this treatment for SMLLCs only for purposes of the like-kind exchanges, that it would be very unclear how you treat the LLC that took that afterwards. Would that result in some kind of damage to the LLC or to our tax law in court, or
I think that it would to the LLC. I don't know if it would all depend on the interpretations that were given, but the issue would be that the law would be much less clear in terms of interpretation, and we would find ourselves in a lot more litigation over the character of what this particular SMLLC is. Is it a part of the parent company, or is it on its own as a separate entity?
So it would be whatever that LLC did after that period. You would be trying to treat it for other purposes the way you always had treated it, but they would then bring forth litigation about being separate?
That's potentially a problem. Or we might say it doesn't exist at all, in which case it might argue, but yes, we are a separate entity. I don't know. It depends on the circumstances of the tax issue involved.
Thank you. Yeah, this is...
Yeah, I was doing good until this.
Well, my question was just whether carving out this particular exception to our law, which is based in separate entities, affected how much effect it has on all of our tax statutes, as right. well as the ability of DRA to function.
If we cut, okay.
And well, that's a fairly large. If, yeah.
Think of it this way: if you have a situation where this is completely within the state of New Hampshire, the parent entity engages in a like-kind exchange where it has a gain. Say, of the $800,000 we talked about. Now, but the replacement property is taken in that SMLLC. You've got uncertainty as to what the basis is in that SMLLC. It should be the $200,000 that the parent had, but it is a separate entity, so should it be the $1 million? And then going forward, when it sells that property ultimately, you may be putting the SMLLC in a position of having a gain that it can't pay tax on because it doesn't have the revenues. There's just a lot of potential issues in mingling those concepts.
That's one reason why they didn't transfer anyway.
Mm-hmm. It should be the lower basis, but then right. then they would pay the gain on the $800 later on
That's right.
in, in which case you don't necessarily know that that SMLLC is financially capable. Also, you're taking that SMLLC now and you're saying, okay, for purposes of all your other deductions, you have to analyze it on a separate entity basis apart from the owner. And you can't offset profits and losses, but it's the intermingling. It's the intermingling that's a problem. We don't allow consolidated reporting in New Hampshire as they do in the feds. We have combined reporting, again, to keep those silos separate.
Yeah, Representative Major?
Well, thank you. And thank you for your testimony. I was wondering if you could provide the committee with some examples of how you interpret this today under existing law, and then what the example would look like if this bill passed. And sufficient examples so that we cover it in general. Because it is a little tough to follow.
A little murky.
Sure.
And with the explanations as you go from one example to the other.
Thank you, Representative Major. I think that might help us all.
Yeah.
I'm a flow diagram type guy.
You don't need it in a flow diagram, though, do you? Thank you.
Any more questions?
No more questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, with some clarification, I'd like to move on to the people supporting the bill. Sandra LaRusso of Portsmouth, representing herself, with written testimony, just one copy for the clerk of written testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Sandra LaRusso, and I am a retired school teacher residing in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I have never testified before, but I feel the need to be here today. I maintain a few properties as part of my retirement. In 2005, I sold a New Hampshire property in a like-kind exchange. I hired an experienced real estate attorney, an exchange accommodator, and an accountant to make sure that I properly reported this exchange. My real estate attorney and the co-buyer of the property asked me to take title in a new replacement property in the name of a disregarded single-member LLC for liability purposes. I was advised that this exchange would be valid and the gain would be deferred. In the spring of 2009, almost 4 years later, the DRA wrote a letter to me and said they are not going to defer the gain like the IRS at the federal level. It was only then that I and my accountant and my attorney in my exchange accommodator learned of this DRA position. I have been assessed $31,000 in tax and $9,000 in interest. The SB 483 is needed. This audit position is unfair to residents like me. I had no notice of the DRA position. It is not reflected in the statute, the rules, or any published written guidance. It is a trap for the unwary. I consulted with an experienced real estate professional. They do exchanges in various states throughout the country, and none was aware of this position. If I was aware of the position, I simply would have taken the property in my own name or not done the exchange. Then I wouldn't be in this position now. I normally don't discuss my finances so publicly, but I feel I have no choice. I am a widow whose sole income comes from the rent of my properties and for my Social Security. I've had to refinance a truck and have a home equity loan taken up recently. I have no way to pay this assessment. If the DRA or the legislator makes a rule, I will follow it. But how can I follow a rule that no one knows about? For these reasons, I respectfully ask that you pass this bill and provide relief to residents like me. Thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Thank you for taking my question.
But I'm just concerned. I'm interested to know how you identify the 1031 professionals that you hired. I mean, were they people that were in fact specialists in 1031 exchanges,
yes,
or people who were holding themselves out as being, you know, this is the first, like, I'm like, you know, the real estate lawyer you used when you bought your house kind of thing, saying he can help you through it kind of thing, or?
No. The real estate lawyer was a Boston attorney that my husband and I had used, and I was familiar with his procedures. I also looked into...
Was he a New Hampshire lawyer?
No.
Licensed in New Hampshire?
The one that I used in New Hampshire was the exchange person, yes. But the lawyer that I used for the real estate was a Massachusetts property, so I used him as the real estate lawyer. At the closing, it's called the intermediary people that take the 1031 exchange was the New Hampshire people. So they were, the only reason that I did an LLC was for liability purposes. I identified the property and I purchased the property in Massachusetts.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And that recommendation to do the LLC, that was made by the Boston lawyer, or was that made by, tell me exactly who made that recommendation to you.
The Boston lawyer, because it was Boston property, and he just thought that I would do better. I was having a co-developer with me, in other words, it was two people buying this property, so basically he thought that was the best way to go. But I am the sole owner of the LLC. There's no other members, and I contend that I am the same entity. That's the problem. But this goes back to 2005. Just wanted to make that point.
Thank you. If you have further questions, thank you. Alex Iskandar, Lebanon, representing himself.
What was the last name?
No, Iskandar. Iskandar.
Alex?
Hello, Alex. How are you?
Very brief background on me. I have a PhD degree from the University of Wisconsin, Madison, in 72. I came to New Hampshire in 75, and I worked for the Cold Region Research Lab for 25 years. I published over 120 technical papers, and I co-edited 11 textbooks. So I am educated person. I have acquired real estate property since 1976, all in New Hampshire. And I lived all the time in Lebanon, New Hampshire, about 35 years. Over the years, my wife and I invested in rental property, providing affordable housing. And in the year 2000, December 2000, I decided to retire at the age of 61 to do something for the family and also for my investment. So I used the 1031 exchange, like-kind exchange, about 10 times. So I am sophisticated 1031. I am not dumb. Except one time that the DRA caught me without knowing, and I have used three New Hampshire real estate attorneys, all local in Lebanon. And I have used a qualified intermediator all the time. I have used a CPA. None of them was aware that when we sell a property, in our, all the property were owned with my wife and I as husband and wife. But in the year 2004, I owned property in South Carolina, shopping center, and I got sued 3 times. So instead of moving from New Hampshire, the cold, and retired in a warm area, I decided to pull back and sell all the property in Florida, Virginia, South Carolina, and buy in New Hampshire. And again, that's all commercial property exchanged. From instead of 220 rental units, we own office building that clean doesn't need me to go every day like I used to when I was young. I'm 71 now. However, I listened to the DRA and say what she is saying is not true. There was no indication from any attorney or myself to know that owning a property in single member LLC, it's the same property. It's just my wife, it has a revocable trust, single member LLC, and I have a revocable trust, single member LLC. And everybody said it's kosher, it's the same. We never thought until 2008, in April, the day on for a Good Friday, and I received a certified letter asking me for $460,000 taxes to the state of New Hampshire that I thought it's a nice state to stay and live and die in. So I changed my mind. I am not going to reinvest in New Hampshire. And if that's true and you don't pass this bill, I'm seriously thinking about exchanging to another state, and I have nothing to keep me. I immigrated to the U.S. at the age of 30. I can immigrate again at the age of 71, and I'll take all my money with me, and the state of New Hampshire would lose hard-working people. So please ask me anything you want to know about. This is unfair, unheard of, and it was not recognized and by any means.
Thank you for your testimony. When you got this bill from the state of New Hampshire in 2008, what did it say?
This is a letter of proposed assessment. It's not the assessment itself. If I sign off and pay, they audit me in 2006. And my file is still open until now. They sent me a proposed assessment from 2003 until 2006.
So then they were assessing you on property from 2003 through 2006?
Yeah, but the other issue is minor issues. The exchange is the big one. The other ones has to do with personal compensation. They're giving me $6,000 while I left a job for $100,000. And I'm doing full-time job, I work all the time, and they're offering me $6,000.
So were any of these properties that they were putting the assessment on exchanged prior to 2006?
Yes, I had one exchange was done 2005. The shopping center in Hilton Head, South Carolina, I sold it for $2,100,000, and I bought, along with another property in New Hampshire, and I bought a big building, $3 million, in Lebanon, New Hampshire, in 2005. And it's the same thing by having two LLC, and they didn't say anything about that. In 2006, they said something. That's 460 for one exchange I did. I took a piece of land in 2000. I bought it in 2000, a farmhouse, 330 acres. And I spent about 4 years getting permits and using my technical background as a soil scientist. And I got a permit for 140 single family home. I, I paid $1 million, I sold it to a Connecticut investor for $5 million. And that's the one, I have $4 million gain. So a piece of land that didn't bring income, now the current owner pay on $10 million taxes. So everybody in New Hampshire making money both ways.
Representative
Major. May I ask the chair a question? Maybe I didn't understand the DRA correctly, but did they testify that they became aware in 2000 of this type of thing in 2006?
Yes, but they would have become aware in 2006 in the 2003 tax returns, because they audit, she told you that they audit 3 years back.
All right.
They seem to have disappeared, but I'm pretty confident with that.
Yeah. Okay.
Correct.
Representative Ashton?
Thank you. Thank you, sir, for taking my question. The specific transaction that was that the assessment comes about from was dealing with land that you had developed into a site that could be made into some kind of commercial development. Now, that land, when you first acquired it, is it your testimony that you first acquired it as part of your revocable trust, and that you could, that when you bought the new property, you bought it as a single member LLC instead of being as the trustee? Is that the transaction we're talking about?
No, we bought it as an individual, husband and wife. It's a farmhouse, and I thought I can retire and have some chicken. But then the town, we're talking about having a village concept, and they wanted a new development. So I thought this land between Lebanon and West Lebanon an ideal. So I volunteered. I wasn't a developer, but I found myself to be a developer. And I spent thousands of dollars and 4 years. So anyway, all the property were husband and wife until I got sued in 2004. So the lawyer advised that I have to have single member LLC revocable trust. So if something gets sued, I only lose that. It's only for protection, liability protection purposes. It's nothing to do with the taxation. So all that I have now, 8 LLC, and I hate all of them. I wish I can go back to individual. In fact, I offered that. I met with DRA and I offered them. I said, if this caused the grief, if it's a mistake from the lawyers, I have a choice to go and sue the lawyers. And each lawyer has an insurance company, and each CPA has an insurance company. Then we go to court, and everybody has filed about 100 lawyers. I don't want to do that. I did not join. There is two class action suits going on. I didn't join anyone. I think I can solve my problem by talking to legislation, you people, and you can understand what's going on.
Council Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Well, you have me a little perplexed in terms of your description of your second entity as being a single-member LLC revocable trust.
Okay.
Because I recognize a single-member LLC in there, and I recognize a revocable trust, but I've never actually heard of one that's combined together.
They did combine both of them. I understand, but I know nothing about revocable trust and LLC before that. But when we sold the property, the money went to the qualified intermediator. And they had conference talk between the lawyers and the qualified intermediator. And they combined the two of them, revocable trust and single member LLC. So the revocable trust owned, and the single member LLC, the one building is owned by two LLC, single member LLC. The first year when we filed income tax, my attorney filed individual for each one. They sent, IRS sent it back. In fact, I forgot to say, I was lucky, I got audited by IRS in 2008, and they agreed on everything. And we gave a copy to the state. The state didn't like it. It doesn't matter. They disagree with the federal.
Representative Ashton?
Would you be willing to, I'm stuck on this entity you're describing, which I've never heard of, and I can't imagine why they would combine the two entities together because they have such different purposes. And I think one of them, the revocable trust, might not have been a taxable entity. And so would you be willing to provide me with a copy of the deed?
Absolutely.
For when you purchased that second property?
I have eight deeds that way. I can provide
okay.
Two or four or whatever. You know, I can
provide. Thank you. Thank you. Sure.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions? Thank you for coming in today. Lynn Merrill, representing the realtors.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
I'm chair of representatives. My name is Lynn Bartlett Merrill, and I am the chair of the Planning Policy Committee for the New Hampshire Association of Realtors. The New Hampshire Association of Realtors is very concerned about the potential adverse effects of this new interpretation of the 1031 exchange law under the business profits tax. And I think you've got a pretty good explanation, so I'm not going to go much further than that. However, I do want to clarify that these 1031 exchanges involving single-member LLCs are not taxed in any neighboring New England state, nor are they taxed in 48 other states. They are taxed at 2%. In the state of Pennsylvania, and they are taxed at 8.5% here in New Hampshire. I think we could all agree that an 8.5% differential will weigh heavily on investors' assessment of whether or not to take possession of property in New Hampshire. I would like to read to you something from George Foss III. He is one of our colleagues here in New Hampshire who is unable to be here to testify today. He works with the firm of Edmund and Wheeler in Littleton, doing 1031 exchanges. And after our Senate testimony, I sent him an email and asked him a couple of questions. And he did want to say a couple of things. The law was passed, the 1031 exchange law was passed on March 8, in 1921, in response to farmers who were selling farmland to World War I veterans who were being hit with a 2% tax on the sale. It passed pretty easily, and except for a few minor tweaks, that does remain in law today. It's widely used by business, and it's been shown for almost 90 years to be an economic booster. There were three southern states who did at one point decide to tax 1031 exchanges. They were Georgia, Mississippi, and South Carolina. Their laws once stated that someone could only use 1031 exchanges within that state, and out-of-state transactions were taxed. So much investment capital literally flew over and around these states that they repealed the laws. And Georgia repealed theirs retroactively. Oregon has had the same law since repealed. Montana considered, then rejected the idea. And in California's recent budget crunch of last year, the idea came up again and was easily shot down. These rules discourage investment. New Hampshire should not be in this group. But even putting aside the business climate, this action is simply unfair and unreasonable. These residents and investors who are putting together multi-million dollar real estate transactions had no practical way of knowing that they would later be subject to the business profits tax. These people did everything right. They did hire attorneys, they hired accountants, they worked with 1031 exchange agents. And at least in one case that we know of, which will be told to you later today, they did indeed call the DRA. And keeping that in mind, that if at any point during the transaction, if they had been told that they needed to tweak it so that they would remain a single person entity, they would have indeed done that. And, you know, if this was so easy to understand, why did so many smart people not know what was going on? The realtors have repeatedly over the last year asked several questions to legislators and others, and we have yet to have a satisfactory response. These are, when did the DRA notify the general public, the legal community, the CPAs, and the 1031 exchangers that this was going to be treated differently? The NHAR is certainly unaware of any such notification. If the DRA believes that they were always treating these transactions subject to the BPT, then why did they not tell the legislator in a letter addressed to the HB2's Committee of Conference in June of 2009 that they were in the process of promulgating rules on the single-member 1031 issue, and we have copies of that letter for you. If this was a tax which had always existed, then how much money did the DRA bring in under the 1031 exchanges in 08, 07, 06, and earlier? NHAR has no way of knowing, but I would strongly suspect that the answer is zero. And it was zero because the DRA was not interpreting the statute as it is now. We all understand the pressures the legislature is under as it copes with its enormous budget concerns. And I don't think anyone in the state would suggest property owners are not paying their fair share of taxes. Quite the opposite. However, we certainly do believe that the state tax policy should be taxation of people who cannot possibly know that they're subject to that transaction. That is just simply unfair. And we are asking you to please help the commercial real estate sector in our state, particularly during these very tough economic times, and support Senate Bill 480. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You said you had a copy of a letter from
George Foss.
You do.
From George Foss. I thought you said you had a copy of a letter that the DRA was doing rules.
We do. I have a copy of that letter that was sent to HB2, the HB2 committee from the DRA.
I'm not sure what you're referring to there, but. Okay. Representative Major.
I have a question for us.
Representative Weiler.
Okay. Is it possible to get a copy of your testimony?
Yes, sir.
You have a lot of good statistics there.
I do. I will forward this to the committee.
Thank you.
I would like to point out that the DRA does respect 1031 exchanges, and you've been discussing it as if they did not. What they do not respect is the disregarded entities, and that's what we're discussing today.
Yes, ma'am. Representative. Madam Chair, that is true. However, the problem is that when you disregard this one particular thing and the word gets out to the other states as it's doing now, people don't understand that it's one little area that has been changed. They just assume that the entire area has been changed, the entire 1031 exchange policy has been changed. And all we're really asking for is that 1031 exchanges be treated in the state of New Hampshire the way they are treated federally and the way they're treated in 48 other states.
Thank you. Representative Weiler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You know, I make this 1031 exchange, and I have property I own as a single person, and I swap it for another property which I then own as a single person. Is there a tax?
No, sir.
Let me give a follow-up. Now, if I take the new property and I put it in an LLC, is there a tax?
I need to defer that to my expert.
I have a handout.
Okay.
That goes right to that point.
Thank you.
He's an individual.
I guess I'll see the answer to that. If he's in the joint transfer,
it's to an LLC. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
With me is one of our realtor colleagues, Donald Eaton.
Yes.
Do you have other signed really technical questions? Do you have other questions?
Oh, I don't think I have Thank you.
Lynn, you know, I have to disclose that I'm a member of your organization. So, and I'm sympathetic to what I'm hearing, but my reservation is this. And that is, as a realtor organization, you're fully aware of what the rules are under the real estate transfer tax.
Yes, sir.
And the entity treatment of single-member LLCs is as a separate entity under the real estate transfer tax, and a transfer between a single person and their LLC would be a taxable event for which a tax would have to be paid on the fair market value under the real estate transfer tax, correct? So that's the problem I have. The problem I have is that people are saying that they had no way of knowing, but on the other hand, we have another law, another tax law, that treats it in a way that everyone really knows how it's being treated. Would you like to comment on that?
I think the only comment that I really have is that the law that they were unaware of is the law that was going to subject this to the business profits tax. And that's what happened.
Representative Hatch.
I'm just along that same questioning. LLC stands for limited liability
company, not corporation.
Yeah. It's a company. So along with that same venue, I'm just not sure why one wouldn't be aware of that, because that's what they're doing. They're changing it from a privately owned item to a separate company. That's
the reason that they're unaware of it is because it was just recently determined that it would be audited in a certain way and interpreted in a certain way. Prior to that, these entities had been interpreted in the same way as they're interpreted federally and in 40 other states. So when this suddenly happened in this state, it was a different matter and it was handled differently. The federal government does indeed have this, interprets this the same way that 40 other states do.
But to say there's no tax, it eventually will be taxed.
Yes.
That needs to be understood, too. So
different.
To say there's no tax, and that's why the federal government recognizes it a little bit different than the uniqueness of New Hampshire, that's all.
Well, could I, let's see. These people, for some reason, the attorneys did not catch on to the fact that a single member LLC was being treated the same way for this purpose as it was for every other purpose under New Hampshire tax law. That I'm taking as a given at this point. Would they all, from now on, just make a 1031 exchange in the way that it is supposed to be done in New Hampshire if this bill is not passed, or is there some impediment to them doing that?
I would need to defer that to one of my colleagues who are more experienced in the area.
Thank you. Okay. So, any further questions?
Thank you very much.
I call Don Eaton, who I guess is representing himself. You didn't put anything down supporting the bill. Representing yourself? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, distinguished members of the committee. My name is Donald Eaton. I'm from Eaton Partners in Manchester. We are in the real estate asset management business, and have been since 1995. I've been in the real estate business since 1985. In general, our company's charge is to grow our clients' wealth through real estate investment, which has to do with management, acquisitions, and dispositions. The majority of acquisitions and dispositions that happen here and around the country are through a mechanism called the 1031 exchange. And as you heard earlier, it was promulgated in the 20s and has served to generate commerce around the country and in this state. In my mind, there's two issues here. One is fairness, and the other is commerce. The fairness issue is that in the past, there have been a number of 1031 exchanges done in the state, and they have not been subject to taxation if they were not subject to taxation at the federal level. Specifically, I have a client who purchased a property in 1991. He is from Manhattan, and he has since purchased a number of other properties, not recently. But he purchased this property in 1991 and sold it in 2005. When he sold it in 2005, he elected to effect a 1031 exchange for all the reasons that have been explained earlier. When he did that, he, of course, hired the proper accountants, attorneys, and so forth. We were the management company for the property, and we were asked to to handle the sale of the property. I found a buyer, and we did sell the property, and he did effect a 1031 exchange and purchased another property. When he did this, he was aware that we had some different tax laws up here in the state of New Hampshire with respect to income tax and sales tax. And he asked me, are there those that I should be consulting to make sure that this 1031 would qualify at the state level? And I said, of course. So that is when we engaged the accountant and the attorneys and so forth. Those folks came back and told him that his transaction would qualify certainly at the federal level and at the state level. In addition, I personally called the Department of Revenue Administration. Now, my guard is down a little bit because I have two experts that are telling me that we're all set. But just to make sure, I called the DRA. And again, my guard was down because we had consulted these folks. And so I wasn't specifically taking notes and making sure I knew who to talk to. And I didn't really even want to ask for a letter from the DRA. I didn't believe that I would get one in any term that would be within the time frames that we needed to exchange the property. But the quote that came back, and I explained the situation, and the quote that came back from the person I spoke with was, "We follow the Fed." That is what they said. And so I explained that to the accountant, the attorney, and my client, and everybody agreed we're good to go. So we exchanged the property, and in the fall of 2008, my client received a letter from the DRA asking him to file a business profits tax return on that sale. And the calculation is that the tax on that exchange is approaching $400,000. My client doesn't have that money, of course, because he invested it in a new piece of property under the guidelines that he thought he was operating under. So he doesn't have this money. $400,000 is a lot of money for somebody to try to come to the table with and pay a tax they didn't even know that they owed. So that's the fairness piece. The reaching back and taxing an unsuspecting investor who's creating commerce up here, which brings me to my next point. It's the commerce of it all. In other states, there are no taxes, and there's no technicalities under which their revenue administrations are taxing these exchanges. Now, there are, my client could have avoided the tax, the specific New Hampshire tax that they're trying to impose. There are two categories. There's a voluntary category of folks that, voluntarily decide to change the entity name. Mr. Iskandar is one of those. He voluntarily changed from his wife and himself to what I understand to be single member LLC, two single member LLCs, one for his wife and one for himself. He voluntarily did that to avoid some liability. My client was financing the new exchange property, the new purchase property, through a lender who required a single member LLC. And that is the crux of the matter here. He went from a certain LLC, Donald Eaton LLC, for example, okay, and he changed it, and he's the only member. He changed it to Donald C. Eaton LLC, for example. One letter in the name, okay? Same taxpayer, no additional members, no less members, and the taxpayer identification number, of course, is the same. Everything's the same. He just changed something very slight to it, to accommodate the lender. But now we're having this issue. Federal government says no problem. State of New Hampshire says you owe $400,000. No other state in the country has this distinction. The state of Pennsylvania, flat tax is 2% every transaction. We have a similar tax, revenue tax, transfer stamps, which are the highest in the country, and our property tax is the highest in the country. So we're already creating some barriers in the state of New Hampshire to investment. By doing this and creating confusion, can it be avoided in the future? Absolutely. Could it have been avoided in the past? Absolutely, if they had known. Now they do know, and they will avoid it. And I'll tell you, if the DRA is successful in effecting these taxes on folks like Mr. Iskandar and my client, they will never purchase in the state of New Hampshire again, ever. And neither will many others. If you make it confusing and convoluted, they won't do it. It's hard enough to understand it as it is. Not all the questions.
Thank you. Representative Wiley and Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Eaton. If I first purchased a property, owned it for $1 million, owned it for 5 years, sold it for $2 million in a 1031 exchange, federal government wouldn't charge me anything for the stepped up value, right?
They would defer the taxes on the gain.
Defer the taxes. Yes. State of New Hampshire would come in and say, I made $1 million and ask for business profit tax.
Not necessarily. If you had changed the name of the buying entity from the selling entity, yes, they would charge you a business profits tax, 8%.
Had I done that, then I owned this exchange property for that's not worth $2 million for another 5 years, and then that doubles again. Now I liquidate at $4 million. Is the feds going to go back to my original base of $1 million?
They do. They capture all of the gain from the first transaction.
From the first transaction. What would the state of New Hampshire do?
From an exchange board.
The state of New Hampshire?
Would they look at the $2 million they'd already taxed me on if I changed to an LLC and then say this, my basis now was $2
million? If you would already paid the tax in New Hampshire? Yeah. I don't believe that there would be any further taxation there.
Right. So if I change the SMLC early on and then go on, but now I liquidate from the 1031 exchange that was worth $2 million. I liquidated $4 million. Still, the money goes to the SMLC.
Yeah.
LLC. What would New Hampshire tax me?
If you would change the LLC again.
No, I kept it.
Kept it the same.
Yeah.
They would have taxed you on the first transaction and not on the second transaction, I believe.
Right. Which is not a 1031 exchange, but an outright sale.
Oh, an outright sale, it all gets taxed.
It all gets taxed.
Right.
What is the basis? The $2 million in New Hampshire and the $1 million in the Fed?
The original $1
million. Thank you. That's what I'm trying to understand. Thank you.
We have Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for taking my question. Actually, I want to ask a question publicly that I asked you privately. And it goes to your third example on your chart here, the John Doe to John Doe SMLLC. If I own properties in my own name, and I have no interest in doing a 1031 exchange, but my attorney has advised me to put my properties into a limited liability corporation, single member limited, the John Doe SMLLC, strictly for purposes of getting legal protection, that's going to be taxed according to this.
It would be taxed at by the state of New Hampshire. It would not be taxed by any other state in the country. It would not be taxed by
follow-up. Then maybe help me understand. When the DRA, when the representatives of DRA were here testifying before, somebody asked a question about transferring property, real property, into a trust, a revocable trust. And I think they said that was not a taxable situation. And Representative Walsh, who's our resident expert over there, is shaking his head yes. Why would they? What's the difference here between the trust and maybe this is a question that
that's why
you can
deal
with. It's
not a sale.
Your question is if they transferred into an SMLOC trust versus an SMLOC?
It's a comparison of the two transactions. In other words, on your chart here, instead of doing a John Doe to John Doe SMLLC, I do it from John Doe to the revocable trust of John Doe.
I'm not sure I can answer that question, Representative Johnson.
Okay. Representative Johnson, we already had that answer from the DRA, which is that a revocable trust is not a business entity.
Okay, yeah, that's right. True. Okay. Thank you.
Representative
Hoskett.
Bones
are
no transferable
chair.
Shares.
Your chart that you've got here.
Right.
It gives scenarios, and we have the state of New Hampshire before the fall of 2008 and the state of New Hampshire post fall of 2008. What happened in fall of 2008 that made these changes happen?
It's my understanding, this is more of a personal response to your questions, that, that there was a charge by the executive branch to have the Department of Revenue Administration to look into additional methods of capturing revenue, as they have done, not just with that department. And so they found this technicality, if you will, in the statute, and said, oh, I think we can apply this to these new entities that are being created either voluntary or involuntary. And that's what changed in 2008. I don't believe that there's any record of any assessment on 1031, whether through a new entity or an old entity, the same entity or a new entity, by the DRA prior to the fall of 2008. I may be wrong, but I don't believe there is. So that's what changed. No rule changed, to my knowledge. It's an interpretation and an enforcement of a technical matter, technical issue.
Yeah.
Mr. Eaton, you've heard from the DRA that the issue for them is that business entities in New Hampshire include LLCs. That is, that an LLC is a separate entity from its owner under New Hampshire tax law. I was a little confused by your example from your client, because first I thought you said that the lender required that he turn it into an LLC, but then I thought you said that the LLC just changed the name.
That's correct. He owned the first property in an LLC, mm-hmm. and purchased the new property in an LLC. Both were single member, and the only thing that is different is a very slight change in the name.
Okay, so that was another what would be an attorney error if people understood the tax basis from the beginning. Are there situations in which a person would have to, on purchasing a property under a 1031 exchange, convert into an LLC in order to get a loan or for any other reason? And is this avoidable?
Are there?
I mean, you talk about the commerce problem.
Yep.
The biggest problem we have is that people did not realize the solution that you're bringing forward is for us to change our entity law. Which
only
is
as
difficult.
It applies to 1031 exchanges. No,
yes, way. I know. Which is difficult in a number of ways. My question is, once people understand what's going on, can they avoid it without causing damage to commerce?
They can avoid most transactions by simply not changing the name. Those that wish to provide additional liability protection, if you will, would not be able to do that. And those that are purchasing properties such as a tenant in common property, where a bunch of investors get together and they purchase a property as their own entities, each individual has an entity that purchases a part of this property, usually in a large transaction, they would not be able to do those transactions. So tenant in common transactions would basically be negated in the state of New Hampshire.
Would those be equal exchanges?
Yes. If I owned a piece of property, if I owned an office building here in Concord, and I wanted to buy a piece of a large building, say here in Concord, for example, and I own my first property in Donald Eaton LLC, the tenant in common, they call it a sponsor, who is putting together this ownership, requires that each of those individuals have a single member LLC, and that they have a what they call a swing vote, that they have another person in the LLC that has, it gets very technical, but it requires the change of an entity, okay, to invest in a tenant in common property. And in order to, and so that would, that would not be allowed by the state of New Hampshire. It is allowed by the IRS. Sorry, could you add that?
So it would be a number of people who already held something in common somewhere else exchanging it for a new property?
Yes. If there were three people that owned something under an entity and those same three people bought something under the same entity, that would qualify under federal rules and the state of New Hampshire.
Yeah. Oh, and the state of New Hampshire.
Yes.
I'm just trying to imagine the federal laws allowing a group to get together and do an equal exchange when they didn't have a group before.
On a tenant in common, each person has an interest in the building that is saleable. You don't have to sell the building to sell your interest. So it's a tenant in common form of ownership, and the federal government recognizes that as acceptable under the 1031 guidelines.
And it's in fact not a single member LLC because it's got two people in it.
No, they're all separate. Each ownership
that they have to have an extra person in the LLC.
Transferable vote or something like that. That's what he said. Right.
More than this small member.
It would be more than a single member. It would be an LLC.
Which is difficult.
But that is accepted in every other state and the federal government, but it would not be here under this interpretation of the rules.
But they get the money eventually, so that's just...
Yes, but aside from that, it's, that would require major rewriting, it seems to me.
Right.
But
this is only a single...
Right.
So... Apparently the bill is now only single member, so that would, it says any other entity treated as disregarded.
Right, exactly.
Which we don't know how many different kinds of entities are treated as disregarded under federal law.
Well, Madam Chair, you couldn't go from a single member LLC to a double member LLC under the federal 1031 and have it qualified. Because there would not be the same persons.
Right.
There would be different entities.
Right.
So
that's
don't
wrong.
Think about multiple LLCs.
He's into that. Yes.
For purposes of the transaction and a tenant in common transaction, it is allowed to add that swing vote member for federal purposes and other state purposes. As I
understand. Madam Chair. Okay. Representative Walsh, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I missed that. That went swinging by.
Okay.
And the term swing, that has to be buffalo.
It has to be what?
It has to be buffalo. When you use the term swing, swing vote. Now, and I presented in what kind, how was that work? The mechanics.
It is my understanding that in a tenant in common investment, that each of the LLCs that are those tenants in common must have a member of it that is typically some corporation or maybe a lender that can. Veto, say, a bankruptcy or some action that would be against the rules of the tenant in common.
So
it's
that,
purely legal.
So that person would be a member of that LLC?
That entity, that corporation, correct.
Bridget is a single member,
yeah, it's not
but then we add in the swing. Mm-hmm. So that becomes a regular LLC with two members. The original buyer and the swing vote, then the swing vote. And they become almost in common with the other tenants.
There's no commerce there.
Yes. All right, thank you.
Okay. Does anybody else have any questions? This witness? Thank you. We have two cards left. I intend to finish these two cards, but for anybody who's in the office who hasn't caught on yet, we're still on the bill that we're supposed to start at 10:30, that we have started about 11:30. And we are going to have to take a break for lunch. So if you're here for the afternoon bill, I think it is going to have to start at 2:30 at the earliest. So I call Dana Pope of Woburn, Massachusetts, representing the Dolben Company, Incorporated, D-O-L-B-E-N, supporting the bill. Please, if you can make it shorter than 7 or 8, that would be
great. We will do that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'm throwing away all my notes, and I'm going to focus on two issues that we've talked about, or I think clarification, one of which the Chair has asked about whether LLCs are required in any kind of a 1031 exchange, or whether they're just something the exchanger wants to do. We did a 1031 exchange in New Hampshire back in 2006. We exchanged out of one property, and we made the investment decision to buy two exchange properties. And DRA has disqualified that exchange. If we had only bought one property, the exchange would have been fine. But we bought two. If we had bought three properties, the exchange would have been disqualified. If we bought five, it would have been disqualified. But if we had bought one, it would have been okay. Why is this? This is because of banking rules. We bought two properties, and the banking rules require, because of bank regulations in practice, that you create what's called bankruptcy remote entities, which is the owner of the property has to have only one purpose, and that is to own that asset. Think about it for a second. If you owned five properties in the same name, same borrower, and one of them had economic travail and went through involuntary bankruptcy, all five properties would be affected because the owner owned all five, so the ownership of five properties went into bankruptcy. The lenders on those other four properties would be drawn into a bankruptcy. So we bought two properties, both in New Hampshire. Our lenders said, you must create a single purpose entity or a single member LLC to be the borrower so that it is bankruptcy remote. So we have two properties that we bought. We created a single member LLC for each of them. They're both owned by the same entity that sold the original exchange property. We had no choice if you want to buy more than one property. Now, under 1031 exchange rules, you're allowed to have, there are two rules regarding the number of properties that you buy. You can either buy three properties of any value, or you can buy any number of properties that you want to buy up to double the value of the property you sold. So, for example, if you sold the property for $10 million, you could agree to exchange into 10 properties up to $20 million. Or you could agree to exchange into three properties of any value. But understand that if you exchange into more than one property, you have to get a single member LLC to be the borrower, owner, of those properties that you bought because of bankruptcy remote laws. Now, the Internal Revenue Code, 1031, contemplates that many tax-free exchanges are going to be done with a buyer or an exchangeor exchanging into more than one asset. The reason for this is the exchange laws are extremely tight and difficult to do. You only have 45 days from the day you sell the first property to the day you declare what you're going to buy. If, God forbid, you enter into a purchase contract with one property, and then the seller of that property reneges on his contract and forces you into court, your 45 days are blown, your tax-free exchange is over. So to protect yourself, you enter into agreements to be able to control several assets, and you more than likely will buy two or more. And we've done four tax-free exchanges. Two were one-to-one. Two of them were we sold an asset and bought two. On one exchange, we sold a property in Michigan. We bought a property in Maryland. We bought a property in New Hampshire. In our situation with DRA, we sold a property in New Hampshire. We bought two more in New Hampshire. But because our lenders required us, because of bankruptcy remote issues to create single-member LLCs. Our exchange has been disqualified, and we've received a bill from DRA for over $1.1 million. Now, we represent over 20% of the $5 million that DRA says is out there, low-hanging fruit. I want to make you understand that in a tax-free exchange, in order for it to go forward, you must take 100% of the cash that comes out of that transaction, give it to a qualified intermediary, and that cash must go into properties that you buy. There is no cash that comes to the exchangeor for business to pay a business profits tax. So if you have a situation where you have to use a single member LLC, and DRA says you come pay us $1.1 million, where's the cash? It is very difficult for any municipality or government to try to collect a dollar of tax when there's no dollar of income in your pocket. So what happens? The fees, the interest, everything starts to climb. There's no cash in these partnerships because 100% again of the gain went into the new assets. In this environment, cash flows are way down. So basically, the DRA is going to own this asset because this claim is going to grow and grow and grow because there's no way to sell or finance your way out of it. Because you took 100% of the cash from the transaction you sold, and under federal 1031 rules, you had to put it into the next deal. None of that money went into your pocket to pay DRA. Now let's suppose that you do not accept 483, and someone does an exchange and buys two assets in New Hampshire. They have no capacity to pay a bill. DRA is going to send, the state of New Hampshire is going to send them a bill, and they can't pay it. There's no money. So the purpose of a business profits tax, and any tax, is to take a little piece of whatever's going by. At the prior hearing, you were talking about taxing gaming winnings. Well, somebody gets $100,000, that you take 10%. Fine, the money's going by, take 10%. But in a tax-free exchange, there's no money going by. Where does the 8% come from? The answer is, there's no place for it. I have lots of other things to talk about, but those are the two primary points that I wanted to discuss with this committee to address the chair's question. Is there a situation where someone has to do a single member's LLC? And the answer is yes. If you exchange into one, more than one asset, under banking rules and regulations to minimize and to make entities bankruptcy remote, you must do a single member LLC.
Could you just clarify, one, you would have to do several.
Yes.
Single-member LLCs.
Let's suppose you sold one asset.
Would not allow you to have the same name.
Cannot. If you sold one asset and bought three assets, you would need to create three single-member LLCs. Each single-member LLC would own one of those assets. All three of those would be 100% owned by the entity that did the original sale. That qualifies as a 1031 tax-free exchange under the federal rules.
Thank you, Representative Hatch.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just, you said you had some other pieces of information that you wanted to share. Do you have it in writing form where you can submit it to the company and it will be looked at, or is that possible?
I'd be glad to create a memorandum for the committee if you would like that.
Thank you.
Yes. I'd be glad to do that.
Yes.
And one further clarification. You talked about bankruptcy remote laws and rules. It's banking rules of which bank?
Well, it's state and federal regulations and guidelines have asked the banks to minimize their exposure to foreclosures and involuntary bankruptcies of borrowers and other assets. And again, as I said, let's suppose that you had a company called Granite State Investment Company and who owned five properties throughout the state. And you decided that one of your assets was going to be the Waterville Palace, and it was luxury condominiums. And that entity is owned by the same entity that owns the other four. And Waterville Palace, for whatever reasons, perhaps you did it in 1989, and the world went down in 1990, and it got foreclosed or went through involuntary bankruptcy. All the other four assets would also be in involuntary bankruptcy, and the four lenders, who were maybe four different lenders on each asset, would be drawn into that bankruptcy. So under the concept of making entities bankruptcy remote, you must have a single purpose entity borrower only in the real estate. It can be a single member LLC, so in fact, there's been no change in ownership.
So this is all banks that
it's driven
do this.
By bank regulations to make to create bankruptcy remote entities.
Is this the Bank of America or is this all
banks? This is state and federal banking regulators.
State and
it affects all commercial real estate lending. We cannot own or borrow in the same name on more than one entity.
Yes.
That's relatively new then, isn't it? Or is it not?
We've been doing it for over 10 or 15 years. I'd say it came out of the economic downturn after the early 1990s.
After that
collapse.
Yeah.
So if you were to go to Citizens today and ask for a loan, they would say to you, does this company or this name that you want to borrow this loan at for this real estate loan, does it have any other business purpose? Does it own any other real estate? If the answer is no, it doesn't matter if it has 50 members in it. It has a single purpose. That can be the borrower. If you say yes, it owns another asset, then they're going to say, we will not lend to you unless you create a single member LLC to own the property on which we're placing our loan.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you for being relatively short, but we would, if you could get us the rest of the testimony, that would be terrific.
You are.
Thank you. I'll call Andrew Gelson of Cohasset, Massachusetts, representing himself in support of the bill with one copy for the clerk.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, distinguished representatives. My name is Andrew Gelson. I work for a company which is a subsidiary of a bank. The company is Compass Exchange Advisors, LLC. Previous to my forming of Compass following my leaving of J.P. Morgan, in which I worked in their like-kind exchange business, I was a practicing real estate attorney for 20 years before that. By education, I think 25 years ago, got my LLM in tax from NYU. By this point in time in my career, I think I've forgotten more tax law than I remember, but that's okay. I think I've worked on facilitating exchanges during the 10 years I've been exclusively focused on that, probably about 2,500 exchanges, probably about 150 of them involving New Hampshire property, either on the sale or purchase side. Clients that we represented range all the way from Fortune 500 companies like John Deere and Macy's and Cargill, down to, for every one of those, there's probably 50 smaller real estate companies as well as individual clients selling one piece of property in which they have tied up the bulk of their savings. Now, my involvement in the particular statute here, now while we don't represent any of the folks who have appeared before the committee, we have had situations exactly like the ones you have in question here, in which someone has sold an exchange property and has acquired property in New Hampshire in a single member LLC. And as other folks testifying before have said, the reasons for doing that are essentially lender concerns, because when you're acquiring personal property, generally if there's any financing needs to be put on at the time of the acquisition, which is the time in which you need to choose the entity in the name in which you want to acquire your replacement property. So for that reason, there really isn't an ability to acquire an individual name and later transfer to an LLC. That must be done at the time of the acquisition if there's any financing involved in acquiring that property. And from our experience, I think that when we have worked with clients in transactions, as the accommodator, we don't necessarily provide tax and legal advice. Generally, the tax and legal advice is provided through their CPA and accountant. Yet we've worked with, I would say, most of the major law firms in Concord, Manchester, and Portsmouth in our New Hampshire transactions. And I can say unilaterally that it was only until recently that this situation has been pointed out as a potential problem with exchanges. They tell us when we study tax law that you should essentially always look to the code, always look to the regulations. And in this particular jurisdiction, if we look at the code and regulations, we look at the particular starting point that we would have. and that starting point is that New Hampshire's business profits tax starts as a base with federal taxable income, essentially, you know, federal net revenue base. And in other states in which there's a tax assessed on the level of the LLC or the separate entity, there's usually some provision in the statute which will state that the state will not recognize something such as the Section 7701, the regulations that treat an entity as a disregarded entity, which is what in particular makes this situation in New Hampshire a gotcha or a surprise. Other states would explicitly say that we follow the Internal Revenue Code as of such and such a date, with the exception of, and one of the exceptions would be for disregarded entities. But since that statutory language doesn't appear in there, I think that it created a trap for the unwary. And if it's only 20 people, I think that's great, because I probably know of over 20. So in the situation which we have, I feel that in the interest of equity, fairness, due process, it seems to me that some relief would be warranted, and for that reason I would support the bill. Now, while the commissioner's interpretation that New Hampshire is firm in its separate entity status is very appealing in its simplicity, I think it's also important to realize that the statute takes as its basis federal revenue law as a starting point, and then the statute seeks to make adjustments to that. And since there's no adjustments, no exclusions appearing in either the statute or in the regulations adopted by the DRA, I feel that the appropriate remedy in this case to exercise fairness and equity to those who are affected would be the passage of this bill. And if there are any questions I can answer, I'll try and keep my testimony brief and answer as many questions as I can. Thank you for the opportunity to give my testimony.
Are there any questions? I think we've got the general idea of all of this now. And I thank you for staying as long as you have, all of you. You did say you had some testimony to give, Mr. Gelson, to give the clerk?
If written testimony?
Written testimony. I have no written testimony.
Oh. No, that was just a mistake on there.
Okay.
Thank you. I would like to point out to people that when you're representing a firm, you should put it down on the representing. But on.
Who was it?
Is there. On Compass Exchange Advisors LLC.
Compass. C-O-M-P-A, yes.
We think.
Yeah, North South.
Right. So, is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against this bill? Then I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 483.